In our previous lecture, we looked at the arguments before the Supreme Court in the five cases that challenged racial segregation in public schools. These cases reached the court for argument in December of 1952. We focused on the arguments of Thurgood Marshall and John W. Davis in the case from Clarendon County, South Carolina, the first case that Marshall filed in his campaign against Jim Crow education in public schools. We saw the dramatic change in the court after Chief Justice Vinson died in September of 1953. Vinson had been reluctant to overturn the separate but equal doctrine of the Plessy case, but his successor as Chief Justice, Earl Warren, was determined to shape a unanimous decision in the school cases. The court finally handed down its ruling in Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, in May of 1954. Warren's opinion held that separate educational facilities are inherently unequal and violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. But the court scheduled further argument on the implementation of its decree and set those arguments for April of 1955. In this lecture, we'll look at those arguments and at the court's final decision in the Brown case. We'll also examine the impact of this decision in both the border states and the Deep South. As white resistance to school integration spread across the South, violence erupted in several communities. The most serious problem arose in Little Rock, Arkansas, when the state's governor called out National Guard troops in 1957 to prevent 9 black students from entering Central High School. The Little Rock situation confronted the Supreme Court with the greatest challenge to its judicial authority in the 20th century. We'll look at the case that reached the court in 1958 after a federal judge delayed further integration in Little Rock. And we'll listen to the voices of Thurgood Marshall and the lawyer for the Little Rock School Board as the justices heard arguments in this landmark case. We'll begin with the final round of arguments in the Brown case on the implementation of the court's ruling that school segregation violated the Constitution. These arguments began on April 11th of 1955 with a new face on the Supreme Court bench. Justice Robert Jackson had suffered a final fatal heart attack in October of 1954. President Dwight Eisenhower picked a successor with an illustrious judicial name. John Marshall Harlan II was the grandson and namesake of the only justice who had dissented in the Plessy case. The second Justice Harlan had practiced for 20 years in an illustrious Wall Street firm. He was a thoughtful, principled judicial conservative, unlike the four horsemen of reaction who had frustrated the New Deal program of President Franklin Roosevelt in the 1930s. Harlan believed in the principle of judicial restraint, but he did not defer to legislative majorities with the dogmatism of Felix Frankfurter. Harlan voted to strike down federal and state laws in free speech cases. He was also the first justice, writing a dissent in 1961, to find a right to privacy in the Constitution. As we'll see, the court followed Harlan's lead in the landmark cases that dealt with contraception and abortion. In the school cases, the court had invited all the states that maintained Jim Crow schools to take part in the oral arguments on judicial implementation of the Brown decision. The justices listened to 16 lawyers, 5 for the NAACP and 11 from the southern states, who spoke for more than 13 hours, spread over 4 days of legal oratory. Thurgood Marshall urged the court to set a single national deadline for dismantling Jim Crow schools. He told the justices firmly that there was no local option on the 14th Amendment. Just because there is a southern area involved, that is no reason to delay it. Marshall asked the justices to rule that integration should begin forthwith and that federal judges should not allow, as he put it, local hostilities and prejudices to delay the process. Many of the southern lawyers who addressed the court sounded more like politicians delivering campaign speeches to their white constituents and promising to defend the southern way of life against judicial meddling. Without exception, they claimed that white parents would refuse to send their children to school with blacks. The most defiant words came from Emory Rogers, who argued for the Clarendon County School Board in South Carolina. Rogers practiced law in the town of Somerton, where the Briggs case began, and he was known as a diehard defender of segregation. He took the place of John W. Davis, who had died after his last tearful argument, and Rogers had none of his wit or charm. His argument sorely tried Earl Warren's patience. The Chief Justice asked if school officials would, in his words, immediately undertake to conform to the court's decree. "I am frank to tell you," Rogers answered, "that I doubt whether the white people of the district will send their children to the Negro schools." Warren pressed him, "You are not willing to say here that there would be an honest attempt to conform to the decree of the district court?" Rogers looked offended by the question. "No, I am not," he replied. "Let us get the word honest out of there." Warren shot back, "No, leave it in." Rogers remained defiant. "I would have to tell you that right now we would not conform. We would not send our white children to the Negro schools." Lawyers in the chamber saw Warren flush with anger. "We thought he might charge Rogers with contempt," one of them later said. After this heated exchange, Solicitor General Simon Soboloff lowered the temperature with a sober presentation of the federal government's position on implementation of the Brown decision. He took a middle ground between the NAACP and the southern states. Soboloff urged the justices to adopt a two-step process. Southern districts should have 90 days to submit plans for ending segregation, but district court judges would decide how much time school officials could have to implement these plans. Soboloff argued that integration should proceed as quickly as feasible. Justice Hugo Black asked him what feasible meant. Soboloff replied that it meant a determination after considering all relevant factors. This was hardly a blueprint for prompt judicial action. The justices met in their conference room on April 16th of 1955, 2 days after the arguments concluded. Chief Justice Warren wanted another unanimous opinion, and he wanted to keep it short and simple. Justice Harold Burton recorded Warren's formula in his conference notes. "Give district courts as much latitude as we can, but also as much support as we can." Warren's final opinion, which he read to a packed chamber on May 31st, was just 7 paragraphs long. He first said that the varied local school problems in different states required federal judges to exercise practical flexibility in shaping their decrees. Judges should consider, Warren said, the physical condition of the school plant, the school transportation system, and revision of school districts into compact areas. The final paragraph of Warren's opinion sent the school cases back to the district judges. They were instructed, as Warren put it, to enter such orders consistent with this opinion as are necessary and proper to admit the parties to these cases on a racially non-discriminatory basis with all deliberate speed. Now, the term "all deliberate speed" was read differently by NAACP lawyers and Southern officials. Thurgood Marshall was encouraged by the court's ruling. "I think it's a damn good decision," he told a friend. Marshall anticipated some initial resistance to school integration, but he was ready to send his legal troops back to federal courtroom. "Those white crackers are going to get tired of Negro lawyers beating them every day in court," Marshall predicted. But he misread the intensity of the white reaction. Governor Thomas Stanley of Virginia took a defiant stand. "I shall use every legal means at my command to continue segregated schools in Virginia," he vowed. Governor James Byrne of South Carolina echoed Stanley. "We will not now, nor for some years to come, mix white and colored children in our schools." Governor Fielding Wright of Mississippi took the most intransigent position. "We shall insist upon segregation regardless of consequences," he promised his white constituents. It seems likely that the justices had not foreseen the consequences of their all-deliberate speed formula. Southern officials read the term as an invitation to foot-dragging, evasion, and outright resistance to judicial decrees. And they received encouragement from the ruling of Judge John Parker in the Briggs case from South Carolina. This was the first case Thurgood Marshall had filed against Jim Crow schools, and it was the first to reach a judicial order after the second Brown decision, just 6 weeks later. Judge Parker made a dutiful bow to his judicial superiors. "It is our duty now to accept the law as declared by the Supreme Court," he wrote. But the rest of his opinion sounded more like a return to the separate but equal doctrine of the Plessy case. "The court," Parker said, "has not decided that the state must mix persons of different races in the schools or must deprive them of the right of choosing the schools they attend. No violation of the Constitution is involved, even though the children of different races voluntarily attend different schools as they attend different churches." Parker ignored the fact that the state requires children to attend school but cannot dictate their church attendance. He went on to offer Southern officials a formula for evading school integration. "Nothing in the Constitution," he wrote, "or in the decision of the Supreme Court, takes away from the people freedom to choose the schools they attend. The Constitution, in other words, does not require integration. It does not forbid such segregation as occurs as a result of voluntary action." Judge Parker, in effect, invited school officials to frustrate integration with freedom of choice plans, which allowed white parents to pick the whitest school in their district for their children. Hundreds of southern districts adopted such plans, most often with provisions that allowed school officials to approve or deny requests for school transfers. Most districts with freedom of choice plans, in fact, routinely denied the requests of black children for transfer to white schools. The fact of white hostility and fears of violence deterred all but the most courageous black parents from risking their children's safety for the principle of integration. The widespread adoption of freedom of choice plans had the effect their sponsors had intended. Over the decade that followed the first Brown decision in 1954, only a handful of black children in the Deep South, from South Carolina to Louisiana, attended school with white children. Surprisingly, the Supreme Court did not address the constitutionality of these plans until 1968. We'll discuss this issue and cases that dealt with the controversial question of busing as a means of achieving racial balance in schools in a later lecture. But we're going to look now at the outbreak of violence that spread across the South in the fall of 1956 and that culminated the next year in the Little Rock case. It's worth noting that all the communities in which resistance to integration led to mob violence were located in such border states as Kentucky, Tennessee, Texas, and Arkansas. The reason is that federal judges had not ordered the admission of black students to white schools in any of the Deep South states, from South Carolina to Louisiana. Let me briefly recount what happened in three small towns in the fall of 1956. Which became flashpoints for white resistance to integration. Clinton, Tennessee, a town of 4,000 in the state's eastern hills, was the site of pitched battles over the admission of 12 black students to the local high school. Led by an itinerant agitator named John Casper, a mob of 1,000 whites blocked traffic around the courthouse square and battered the cars in which blacks were riding with baseball bats. Whipped into a frenzy by Casper's racist diatribes, the mob overwhelmed the local police and chased blacks through the streets. Just in time to avert a bloodbath, 100 state highway troopers dispersed the mob with tear gas and arrested Casper. The next day, Governor Frank Clement dispatched 600 National Guard troops and 7 tanks to patrol the town and restore order. Mansfield, Texas, a small town near Houston, erupted in violence after a federal judge ordered the admission of 3 black students to the local white high school. A mob of 400 whites swarmed onto the school grounds, waving placards that read, "Dead coons are the best coons," and $2 a dozen for nigger ears. The black students decided to remain in their segregated school. And in the western Kentucky town of Sturgis, where 9 black students enrolled in the white high school, armed mobs roamed the streets until National Guard troops forced them back with rifles and bayonets. The black students endured racial epithets for weeks until the white hecklers finally dwindled and departed. Now, I've recounted these episodes of violent resistance to school integration for two reasons. First, millions of Americans saw pictures of screaming mobs and National Guard troops on television news reports and weekly magazines. And many people associated integration with violence. Secondly, those who whipped up the mobs learned that reporters and television crews would flock to cover the turmoil and disorder. And bigots like John Casper were not the only agitators who could inflame a crowd. As we'll see, even the governors of southern states fueled the violent resistance to school integration. We're going to look now at the city of Little Rock, Arkansas, in September of 1957. The city school board had adopted a plan of phased integration, beginning with the admission of 9 black students to Central High School. Integration of other high schools and then junior highs and grade schools would be phased in over a 10-year period. The Little Rock Board made no bones that its plan was designed, as its chairman said, to produce the least amount of integration spread over the longest period of time. Most whites in Little Rock supported the plan, but the city's racial bigots flocked to a speech by Governor Marvin Griffin of Georgia, who visited the city a week before schools were set to begin classes. Griffin had won election on a pledge to resist integration by any means possible. His speech in Little Rock denounced the Supreme Court justices as communist sympathizers, and his audience responded with cheers that reached the ears of Arkansas Governor Orville Faubus. The night before the 9 black students were expected at Central High, Faubus appeared on television and warned that blood will run in the streets if they entered the school. Faubus announced that he was ordering National Guard troops to surround Central High and keep the black students out. The next morning, a white mob surrounded the school, shouting racial epithets as the Little Rock Nine approached its doors. The mob cheered as National Guardsmen turned them back with raised bayonets. One of the black students, a 16-year-old girl named Elizabeth Eckford, was surrounded by a menacing crowd. Someone hollered, "Get a rope and drag her over to this tree." Elizabeth finally escaped the mob on a city bus. But millions of Americans witnessed the turmoil on national television. One of those who saw these reports was President Dwight Eisenhower. 2 weeks after violence erupted in Little Rock, he ordered 1,000 paratroopers from the 101st Airborne Division into the city. The federal troops restored order and patrolled the streets around Central High for the rest of the school year, but the 9 black students endured taunts and shoving inside the school. In June of 1958, the Little Rock School Board persuaded a federal judge in Little Rock, Harry Lemley, to halt the integration plan for another 2 years. School officials told Judge Lemley that, as they put it, chaos, bedlam, and turmoil would result if the integration plan was not delayed. Lawyers for the NAACP appealed Lemley's order to the federal appellate court in St. Louis, which reversed his ruling in August, just 3 weeks before Little Rock schools were scheduled to open. But the appellate judges granted the board's request to keep Lemley's order in place, while its lawyers filed an emergency appeal with the Supreme Court. During these legal maneuverings, Governor Faubus persuaded the Arkansas legislature to give him the power to close any of the state schools as a means of frustrating any judicial orders to integrate them. Faubus made clear that he would close down all of Little Rock schools if the Supreme Court reversed Judge Lemley's ruling that integration be delayed. When the school board filed its appeal in late August of 1958, the justices were scattered around the country on their summer break. The court was not scheduled to begin its next term until the first Monday in October. But Chief Justice Warren recognized the importance of this issue, and he called his colleagues back to Washington for a special hearing on August 28th. The court's chamber was crowded with lawyers and spectators as Warren called the session to order for arguments in the case of Cooper versus Aaron. William Cooper was the school board president, and John Aaron was the first in alphabetical order of the black children whose parents had challenged Judge Lemley's order. But it's fair to say, I think, the real parties were Governor Faubus and Chief Justice Warren. Faubus had vowed to defy any judicial order to integrate Little Rock schools, and Warren viewed his threat as a direct challenge to the court's authority and also as a personal affront. The legal issue before the court was simple. Did Judge Lemley exceed his authority in delaying integration for another 2 years because of the school board's fears of disorder in the schools? We're now going to listen to excerpts of the oral arguments in Cooper versus Aaron as they were recorded in the court's chamber. Let me introduce these recordings with a brief explanation. After the Brown cases were decided in 1954 and 1955, Chief Justice Warren recognized the historic importance of the court's arguments. He felt they should be recorded on tape so the American people could hear those arguments. Warren had microphones installed on the lawyer's podium and on the court's bench to record the arguments as well as questions by the justices. In several of our following lectures, we'll listen to excerpts of the arguments in such landmark cases as Miranda versus Arizona, the Pentagon Papers case, and Roe versus Wade. In my view, hearing the lawyers and the justices in these historic arguments is like having a seat in the court's chamber, adding a real-life dimension to the cases we'll be discussing. We're first going to hear from Richard Butler, a prominent Little Rock lawyer who represents the city school board. Butler begins with these words.
It is impossible for the school board at Little Rock to operate a school program for the 2,000 students at Central High School on an integrated basis at this time, and that unless the plan of desegregation is postponed for a reasonable length of time, that irreparable harm will be inflicted upon the students of both Negro and white race.
Chief Justice Warren expresses sympathy with the school board's problems, but he doesn't want mobs to decide legal questions. He poses this question to Butler.
Well, Mr. Butler, I think there's no member of this court who fails to recognize the very great problem that your school board has. But can we defer a program of this kind merely because there are those elements in the community that will commit violence to prevent it from going into effect?
Mr. Chief Justice, I think so, but not directed to the people who form mobs, not directed to the people who are law defiers. We're not standing up here trying to argue for their side of it.
I know you're not.
We are arguing for the great mass of people throughout the South who, I say again and will say again and again, are not law defiers. They want to follow the law, but they, as of this moment, without certain state statutes having been tested in court, do not know just exactly what the law is in a particular given circumstance.
Butler refers to the claims of Governor Faubus that Arkansas had no duty to obey the Brown decision. Chief Justice Warren responds with outrage.
The point I'm making is this, that if the governor of any state says that a United States Supreme Court decision is not the law of the land, the people of that state, until it is really resolved, have a doubt in their mind and a right to have a doubt.
But I have never heard such an argument made in the Court of Justice before. And I've tried many a case over many a year. I never heard a lawyer say that the statement of the governor as to what was legal or illegal should control the action of any court.
After this heated exchange, Thurgood Marshall takes the podium to speak for Little Rock's black children. He tells the justices what they endured in the face of mob violence.
But I think we have to think about these children and their parents. These Negro children that went through this every day. And their parents that stayed at home wondering what was happening to their children. listening to the radio about the bomb threats and all of that business. I don't see how anybody under the sun could say that after those children and those families went through that for a year, to tell them all you have done is gone. You fought for what you considered to be democracy and you lost. And you go back to the segregated school from which you came. I just don't believe it. And I don't believe you can balance those rights.
Marshall shifts from his role as a lawyer and speaks to the court more like a teacher.
Education is not the teaching of three R's. The education is teaching of the overall citizenship, to learn to live together with fellow citizens, and above all, to learn to obey the law. And the damage to the education in Arkansas and in Little Rock and in Central Iowa comes about through the order of Judge Lemley, which says that not only the school board and the state can and should submit to mob violence and threats of mob violence, but that the federal judiciary likewise should do so.
Marshall tells the justices that Central High's white students need a lesson in citizenship.
I don't know of any more horrible destruction of principle of citizenship than to tell young children that those of you who withdrew, rather than to go to school with Negroes, those of you who were punished last year, the few that the school board did punish, come back, all is forgiven, you win. And therefore, I'm not worried about the Negro children at this stage. I don't believe they're in this case as such. I worry about the white children in Little Rock who are told, as young people, that the way to get your rights is to violate the law and defy the lawful authorities. I'm worried about their future. I don't worry about those Negro kids' future. They've been struggling with democracy long enough. They know about it.
The justices were determined to teach Governor Faubus a lesson in citizenship. Following this dramatic argument, the court handed down its unanimous ruling on September 29th of 1958, reversing Judge Lemley's delay of integration in Little Rock schools. To emphasize their resolve, every justice signed the court's opinion. They professed astonishment that Faubus and the Arkansas lawmakers would claim, as the opinion said, that they are not bound by our holding in the Brown case. It was their defiance of judicial orders, the court stated, that had brought about violent resistance to that decision in Arkansas. And the justices made clear that state officials must obey what they called the command of the Constitution, that judicial orders be followed. They put their own command in these words: no state legislature or executive or judicial officer can wage war against the Constitution without violating his undertaking to support it. But despite this stern judicial lecture, the Arkansas officials did not learn their lesson. Defying the court once again, Governor Faubus closed down Little Rock schools for an entire year. The NAACP lawyers went back to federal court and won a ruling in 1959 that reopened the schools. Little Rock's voters finally tired of chaos and turmoil in their schools and elected a new school board that moved toward compliance with court orders. But this disturbing episode in our nation's history raises a crucial question. What good is the Constitution if government officials refuse to obey its commands? We'll return to this question in a later lecture, when we look at President Richard Nixon's refusal to comply with a judicial order to turn over tape recordings of his Oval Office conversations in the Watergate case. But the Little Rock case set an important precedent, making clear that Supreme Court rulings were, as the justices said with one voice, the supreme law of the land. We've seen in this lecture that Chief Justice Earl Warren exercised firm leadership in guiding the court to its unanimous decisions in the school cases. We'll devote our next lecture to Warren's approach to the Constitution and examine several of the landmark cases in which he left a lasting impact on American society.